Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we gather here at the station of KHOY Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. The center of Ames, the center of Iowa, the center of it all. Welcome to our kitchen table. We have quite a lot of things to cover on the Donalana Kitchen today. First, I want to mention, Donna, last Saturday was a movie night at KHOY. You were there.
Yeah, and it was packed. A lot of people that we know from around town, like over 75 people.
That's pretty good.
That's a big thing. But the movie was very special to Ames Salana. Tell us about it.
Oh, this was a movie by the filmmaker Brittany Prater, and the name of
who grew up in Ames. Yes.
She told her story.
A young woman. She's not a girl anymore.
Told her story, and the movie's called Uranium Derby. Quite a while ago, and I remember, because I was here, there was a big controversy about, well, you know, Ames is famous for a lot of things, but also it was involved in the Manhattan Project, ISU was, and did some uranium refining experiment sort of thing.
Yes, we still have, what's that part of ISU that's run by the Department of Energy? The Ames Lab, right?
Yes, it is, and they're still looking into that. But at the time, they had all this leftover stuff, and the leftover stuff was buried in a location in Ames.
Which we call fondly Reactor Woods.
Oh, yeah, that's good. So anyway, this movie is about that.
About the buried nuclear waste in Ames, yes.
Right, right. And, you know, just because you bury something, Donna, doesn't mean it goes away.
It just means you don't see it for a while.
Oh, my. So there has always been kind of this unsaid, well, it was talked about, but it was kind of squashed under the table by powers that be, including the Department of Energy, who thought that that was not a good thing to talk about. And so Brittany Prater did a good job with this movie, and
it's a documentary, and she talks about not only the history of how it happened and who the people were and how it affected their lives here in Ames, but then she gets into the chemistry of it so that we understand what these isotopes are and how the bomb was made. Now, I think that there should be more interest. You know, this summer, there's a big mega major studio picture coming out that is a biopic. So it's not, I guess you wouldn't call it fiction, but it's about Oppenheimer. And about his life and what he did. So that will bring in a renewed focus on these issues. But we got our own story here in Ames, and it's a really well-made film. Brittany is a professional editor, so she knows what she's doing.
Yes.
And thank you so much to her for doing all of this.
Yes, the film is called Uranium Derby. Keep your eyes and ears open for that. Yes.
Yes, and we will, apparently, Mike tells us, try to have another screening of it here in the station. So stay tuned.
Yeah. Yeah, very good. See, it's one of those things we should know about, but we don't want to talk about. And here on the Donalana Kitchen, we talk about food-related things, and there are things in our food production system that, well, we just mainly don't want to talk about it. And one of those things is how we treat animals. I often thought that the term, the humane treatment of animals, is rather a oxymoron when we find out about what we do to our, confined animals that we raise for food production. So, Donna, we've got some news here. There are news items from the Donalana Kitchen News Department. Go for it.
The Supreme Court ruled this week on the California law that outlaws pork raised in gestation crates to be sold in California. Now, a few months ago, we had John Gilbert on talking about this upcoming issue at the Supreme Court. He's a local Iowa farmer, and pork is one of his products, and he sells to Nyman Ranch. And so he talked about the model that they use. And Nyman Ranch, of course, does not use gestation crates at all, and their pork can easily be sold in right into the California market, as are other, there are other companies around, certainly in Iowa, and other companies also doing this.
Just to kind of identify, a gestation crate is keeping an animal really, really confined, not just in a pen.
Right. They can't turn around. They can't, you know, supposedly the gestation crates were instituted so that the pigs, mother pigs, would not roll over on the baby pigs, and it's supposed to be safer and rah, 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 rah. And the,
however, yeah. It doesn't sound so good to me. Anyway, people have been worried about these gestation crates for quite a while, and California kind of did this amazing thing.
Yeah,
they listened to their consumers.
Right, they did a referendum in California, which means people actually vote on this issue. This wasn't just, you know, the Humane Society got something run through the California legislature. This was voted on, and obviously a majority, but a fairly significant majority, I believe, voted to make this proposition that those kinds of pigs and chickens, it also applies to something, I think they're called battery cages, where the chickens are like crammed into these little cages and can't move around. And
all they do is drop their eggs through the floor.
And their poop, too.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, part of this industrial system, you know, people are still, when you buy milk, you don't think of, or eggs or meat. You're in your mind, you are still picturing, I mean, and we all do this, the cow out in the pasture, the chicken pucking around in the dirt, because that's how, for the vast majority of all civilizations on the planet, that's how animals were done. So this newish kind of, you know, certainly in the last 50 years, if not shorter time period, these kinds of confinement things have become, unfortunately, the norm. So when consumers who do not live near farms, although Iowa is, of course, a very large egg and pork producing state. So the Supreme Court ruling came out, and some of our Congress people were going this kind of, well, you can't take my bacon away. This is affecting Iowa bacon, yada, da, da, da. Well, as a matter of fact, that's not correct. It is affecting some of the Iowa pork producers, but certainly not all of them. You know, like all the Nyman Ranch producers and all of the other, you know, pastured pork systems, or even some of the CAFOs. So this is, I learned this from my son, who Arian Tubumari, who is in the meatpacking business, and he really laid this all out for me, because I kept reading the headlines and going, well, now why did the Supreme Court make this decision that way? And he said that the main issue, you know, underlying the whole thing is the difference between interstate commerce and intrastate commerce. So with interstate commerce, that's the federal government that regulates anything that moves between the states and around the country. Intrastate is within the state, and that is legislated by each individual state. Now, there are a lot of laws that are intrastate, you know, specifically some environmental laws, and California has a lot, but California is not the only state that has these laws. California's, like, their emission laws are different than other states. They also have certain questionable chemicals, possible carcinogens, have to be listed on a label. So when a big state like California makes this law that things sold in California have to be a certain way, it encourages the market. I mean, it's all voluntary, but if they want to sell it in California, they have to, you know, follow the law. Just like when you buy a wine bottle or a soda bottle or a soda, they'll say on the label, it says 5 cent or whatever in Iowa. That's an Iowa law. Those are intrastate laws. So basically the Supreme Court, it's not that they were so in favor of outlawing gestation crates and they want to be human activists and animal welfare advocates, it's that they were having to rule on the solidity of an intrastate legislation. So, and if that had been overturned, it would have affected all the other intrastates legislations and all, you know, all kinds of things. So that was the basis of how the Supreme Court managed to do that. Now, the other thing that needs to be clear, and our, you know, Congress people who are making all these outrageous, oh, we've been hurt by this law, they need to know this. This law does not cover, it doesn't outrule CAFOs at all. It simply outrules, overrules or outlaws the gestation crate aspect, which is only how the pregnant sows give birth. What you do to the pigs afterwards is not covered in this law at all. And there are many, my son pointed out to me that there's been this gestation crate issue, has been a publicity issue for long enough that many large pork producers, including the CAFOs, are changing their strategy so that they're actually not, they are less and less using these gestation crates already. So it's not like this California market is suddenly going to jeopardize, you know, our national pork industry at all. And so I believe that our legislators that are like, oh, save our bacon, you know, nah, 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 they're kind of speaking out of both sides of their mouth. It's not really going to affect Iowa pork producers, except maybe some of the larger, more egregious ones, who I might add are perhaps contributing to their campaign funds. So, yeah.
Do you think? Yeah, maybe.
It's a possibility. Well, I didn't go through the list who their contributors are, and I'm not sure what position the Iowa pork producers is taking, but one can guess. And from the kerfluffle of comments in the last few days from not just our local Congress people, but also our Senate candidates, some of them, and I'm not saying names here because we don't like to be political, but I would consider their pronouncements ill-informed.
Well put, Donna.
All right. There we go. That was my soapbox for the day.
So we'll think about how our animals are treated. I mean, if we're going to eat meat, let's be a little cognizant of how it happens here. Now, I have another news item from the Donna Lana Kitchen News Department. Tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick. That's our ticker tape. This one, very unexpected, and my goodness, some good news here. Deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon fell 68% in April compared with last year, reflecting positively on the administration of Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. I mean, this new guy came in and said, well, we're going to stop this. And it looked like he's making some inroads. There's a lot to be fixed down there. A big ag, big chemistry, big everything is pretty entrenched. But still, the clear cutting is slowing down noticeably. And parts of the Amazon are often referred to as the lungs of the earth. And
yes.
They provide things like oxygen and do things with carbon dioxide. And let's be a little careful there, too. Most of the deforestation occurred under the Bolsonaro administration. It was illegal and fueled by logging, mining, and agribusiness companies that were given the green light by him. And so here's a little bit of good news for the environment. The deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon is at least slowing down.
Yeah, and that affects all of us. That is good news because the lungs of the Amazonian rainforest are important that they stay healthy. And it's really, for me, I felt like, wow, that statistic of over such a short time,
yeah,
because the election wasn't that long ago. So Lula's been in, I don't know, a few months or something. I don't remember.
Turn of the year, I think.
Yeah. And to make that much significant change in a major environmental concern so quickly, is remarkable. It does show how important political leadership is.
Yes. Number one, stop doing the bad thing, and then we'll get on
well,
with
and
the
that
good
it can
stuff.
Be done.
Yes, it
when,
can be.
When there's the will and the ability of the political figures to make those changes. Oh, hello. We can turn these things around.
We can. Well,
bravo to Brazil. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Good example on the planet.
Good. Good. I said we had lots of different things to talk about today, and we're going to jump from big global political issues to something in our backyard, something in our garden, how to grow and eat and enjoy rhubarb. We talk about rhubarb
every
year.
It's rhubarb season.
We talk about it every year because rhubarb happens.
Well, and the interesting thing about rhubarb is it's one of the few really seasonal things that we get. I mean, you can now buy asparagus and strawberries all year long, but really, unless you're buying frozen rhubarb, you do not see rhubarb in the markets.
Yeah.
And now is the time.
It's the time. And it's a friendly thing. It shows up in yards as, you know, it just kind of takes care of itself. It's a very hardy plant. Many folks think of rhubarb as a fruit. Huh? Likely because it's so often sweetened and paired with fruits, but it's actually a perennial vegetable. Yes. You didn't know that. Well, it is. It is.
Well, I did read there was a period in our domestic history where they actually, the USDA decided to classify it as a fruit because so many people thought, but that's, you're correct. It is actually a vegetable.
Well, I think, technically, tomatoes are a fruit.
Yes.
I mean,
Yeah.
But you don't want to upset people
too much. Well, there's public folkloric interpretations, and then there's biology. So.
Yeah. So one thing about rhubarb is that it's kind of like zucchini. People come up to you and say, so you want some rhubarb?
Because it comes this time of year, heavy. I've got some. We actually have some at KHOI. Lana's got some. Everybody has got a lot of rhubarb.
And we are.
Hallelujah.
We are blessed with rhubarb.
We are.
Friends or neighbors grow it. And you can actually, go out and buy some plants. Or it does grow from seed, although it takes a while.
But you have to be a Lana gnome to be able to grow it from seed something.
Patience. You can do that. I got a question from a friend asked me if she could transplant rhubarb at this time of year. It you have to be careful. The business end of the rhubarb is all underground.
It's called a crown, isn't it?
A crown. It's this great lump. This great lump that pushes itself out of the ground. And if it starts making leaves, well, yeah, I suppose you could. You could transplant it, but you're going to set it back a bit. It will probably come.
Well, is there a better time of year to transplant?
Do you know, in the year, very, very early in the year before, a lot of leaves are up. I mean,
early spring.
Yeah.
And or what about in the fall?
In the fall, you can do it, too, after it's died back. Think of it kind of like an iris or something.
Sleeping, yeah.
Yeah, when it's sleeping, yes. Because it comes out of the ground. It kind of looks like a big, huge pimple coming out of
it. It is. It definitely has that eruption feeling.
Yeah. Where to plant your rhubarb is pretty important.
Sun!
Sun. It's a sun. It expands, and it is a perennial. It will come back, and it will expand. It will grow. So put it in full sun, and it does like amendments. Like if you have some well-rotted horse manure or something that is lovely.
Oh, it can take richer soil, so yeah, I should fertilize it then.
It lives any old place, but really if you want nice big stalks.
I guess I'll get my fish emulsion out.
Yeah, just, you know, kind of help it along a little bit.
Well, now the wonderful thing, if you buy a crown, like from the farmer's market or wherever you buy these things, and you put it in the ground, you don't pick it the first year, and you don't pick it the second year. Uh-huh. You wait. You give it a chance to get really happy in that spot, and then it just goes gangbusters. And I actually put in about 5 or 6 in this really sunny spot under my bay window because I think it's really pretty.
It's a nice thing.
It has these gorgeous, huge leaves, huge. And it has a, you know, it's like, okay, I did my first picking yesterday, and I kind of, you know, selectively go in there and take the bigger ones out because it keeps going for another, 2 months you can push it.
Oh, yeah. A note, and I've always done it this way because another gardener told me this. When you pick your rhubarb, don't cut off the rhubarb.
Yes.
Give it a little tug, and it'll pop off, clear down where right. it catches.
You have to get your hand down in there and pull nearer to the ground.
Nearer to the original, the crown, mm-hmm. and it'll pop off. It's not that it'll kill a plant, but it's best not to leave those cut open branches sticking up. It's good to have it, call it a clean break. Go down there and mm-hmm. kind of pop them off. And remember that only the stalks of rhubarb are edible. The leaves should be discarded. Compost them because they contain oxalic acid, which can be poisonous. Although
spinach has some of it too, but apparently the leaf of the rhubarb has enough that it will be toxic if you eat it. So you always cut, you know, the ends, both ends off. Mm-hmm. I hope this isn't wrong. I throw them in my compost pile.
No, I put them in.
It's okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other thing, it does send up these tall stalks that are rather odd looking, but they are flowers.
Yes. Yes. They're intensely funny looking.
They're very primeval looking. They're kind of interesting. But I usually clip mine off because it does kind of take in. I mean, since it's a plant that you are trying to grow to eat, you want more stalks. So if you cut the flowers mm-hmm. off when they pop up, it doesn't take, as they say, energy away from the plant.
And they are, some of them are flowering now because it's called bolting. Because if they don't get enough, if there's too much hot or there's too much dry early, and we had a very dry spring, I consider it prematurely bolting. But yes, I'm cutting mine off too. Or again, I'm going down there and popping them off if I can, or cutting them off really close to the ground. Another rhubarb question, or another fact about rhubarbs. Rhubarb doesn't always come in red stalks, huh? It is a variety. There are different varieties. There are different varieties that are red or mottled red and green or just green. And actually, they're all flavorful. They're all good. They're not waiting to ripen. If you have a stalk of rhubarb that looks big and green, it's ready. So, yeah, that's good.
Yeah, and another thing, if you're buying rhubarb at the grocery store or someplace and not picking it yourself, if it's floppy, it means it's been cut too long. You want your rhubarb crisp and, not
floppy.
Not floppy. Yeah.
All right. So we're encouraging people to go out there and get their not floppy rhubarb. Good. Let's take a little break here and come back and talk lots more about rhubarb. You're listening to KHOI Community Radio, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Donna Lana Kitchen, we are talking rhubarb. And rhubarb, I want to mention some rhubarb recipes in a brand new recipe book put out by the Iowa Farmers Union. It's called Iowa Farms to Iowa Families, Farm Fresh Iowa Recipes and Stories and Pictures. Good. I I just happen to have a recipe in the book myself, and I, wow, this is a rhubarb recipe that I sent, and this recipe is also on the Donalana Kitchen.
Yes, this is one of Lana's best loved, most famous recipes.
It's rhubarb season, so here we go. Rhubarb orange jam. It's good. It's good. It's not quite a marmalade, but the oranges make it marmalade-ish. Ingredients: 1/2 pound oranges, 3 1/4 pounds rhubarb, cup sugar for the oranges, because you cook sliced oranges in sugar and a little water, cook it down until
you just slice the whole orange, not just the peel.
Not just the peel, the whole orange.
And just take the seeds out. Yeah. Right.
3 1/4 cups sugar to finish the jam, and juice of a small lemon. Like I say, you cook the oranges until they are translucent.
So you put the lemon in, certainly not for the sourness, but yes, to make it?
No, to make it, yeah. Actually, lemon helps things gel.
That's what I thought. Okay, yes. So it has to do with the consistency of the jelly.
Yes.
Yes, that's what I thought.
Wash the orange slices and slice them into thin rounds. Remove the seeds in a preserving pan, which you're going to cook in. Poach the slices with 1 cup sugar and 1 cup water until they're transparent. And then add the washed and diced rhubarb, lemon juice, and sugar. And you have to bring it to a good boil for 5 minutes. If I make a double recipe of this, I add pectin because it doesn't gel. But just this size recipe gels just by itself. Stir gently, and cook it for 5 minutes. It'll start getting thick a little bit, and then put it into sterile jars and seal.
So you just hot pack it.
I just hot pack it.
I love it.
Good. And there is also a recipe in the Iowa Farms to Iowa Families book by someone named Patricia Tate from West Branch, Iowa. And this reminds me of a pie my mom used to make. Rhubarb custard pie with meringue.
Oh, that's got everything in it.
Yeah, of course. So the pie filling, rhubarb, 3 egg yolks, 1.5 teaspoons of vanilla, 1/3 cup flour, 1 1/4 cup sugar, and 1/2 cup heavy cream. Make your custard, put it in, and then
yummy.
Make your meringue. Oh, it's good.
And then since you got the egg whites left over,
that's
put
it.
The meringue on the top.
Wow. Save the whites for the meringue. Perfect. And that nice, soft, custardy meringue. That's good. Iowa Farms to Iowa Families by the Iowa Farmers Union. A cookbook. Good.
Right. You can probably go to the Iowa Farmers Union website.
Right. IowaFarmersUnion.org and find it. It's good. It's got a lot of good stories and pictures in it, too. So thanks to them for bringing that up and... 2 good rhubarb recipes, but I'm sure Donna has more things you can do.
Oh, more rhubarb recipes. You know, you have to understand, it reminds me of my grandmother, right?
Me too.
Rhubarb and grandmothers, that kind of goes, you know, because it's historically a seasonal vegetable and that sort of thing. And the other thing that we forget is probably at least when our grandmothers were young, and maybe longer than that, people did not have access to lemons, at least unless you lived in a Mediterranean climate. So
or maybe Florida. Okay.
Midwesterners did not, you know, have citrus, except maybe an orange that was imported and was on your Christmas stocking or something. It was a big deal. So rhubarb is one of those sour things that we had easily around to, you know, cook with.
Mm-hmm.
So you can use rhubarb in a lot of ways that you would use lemon, and I like to do that. So here I went looking for recipes, and I made something I want Lana to try on air. I was looking for some savory applications of rhubarb. So this is
it's thick. It's extremely magenta.
Yeah.
It's a soup.
It's beet and it's almost it tastes like a borscht, which is often used as vinegar or something, but it's a soup. I got this is a Nigella Larson recipe. I was looking for, you know, not of course you can make jellies and jams and pies and things like that. But this beet and rhubarb soup, what do you think? Doesn't even taste like rhubarb, does it?
No. I like borscht, but actually this doesn't have any meat stock in it. I mean, borscht sometimes has chicken
right.
stock.
Right, This is great. As we discovered in our Ukrainian show, borscht means soup, basically. Mm. This one is good. I had it hot last night, but it's good cold.
Oh, it's good cold.
Yeah.
Oh, it's wonderful cold.
So I'm going to tell you what's in this recipe. It actually was so easy. So this is Nigella Lawson, as I mentioned. You can probably Google it. I found it online. Beet, rhubarb, and ginger soup. So you mix 14 ounces of rhubarb and 1 pound, 2 ounces of beets. So that's kind of, let's say, slightly less rhubarb by weight than beets.
Right. When I do a recipe, I would look at that and say, some and some. I mean, you guess. Okay, there you go.
And so basically what she's doing is she says take a large onion and, cut it into a large dice, 2 tablespoons of olive oil. So you saute the onions a little bit because they're all going to cook later, but you're looking for that caramelizing kind of flavor. And then you put in minced garlic. She says 3 fat cloves as the onions are towards the end of the cooking there. 2 teaspoons of ground cumin. And 2 teaspoons of, no, a 1 teaspoon of fine sea salt. And then you add 4 cups of cold water. Now, I would say that if you wanted to put homemade chicken stock in there, it would be really good. But that's all it is the beets are not even peeled. You know, you take the bobbly bits off of them and cut the stem and the top. Yeah, and just put them into a large dice and you throw the rhubarb and the beets in at the same time.
All together.
With 4 cups of water. And then you just cook it, as I say, cook it till it's done. Because what you're going to do is puree it.
Ah.
So I used my immersion blender.
How long did beets take a while?
Yeah, you want the beets to be really soft. Nah. So she suggested about 1.5 hours, and I kind of did that. But I waited till I poked the beets with a fork, and they were really, really soft. And then I went, oh, it's done. And then she stirs in some ginger juice at the end of it. Of the cooking. Now, I did that here, but you didn't get a strong ginger flavor.
I didn't taste ginger.
No.
Cumin I get. And yes,
But it does add a nice little...
Oh, yeah.
And she serves it with, let's see, what did she say? Something she calls a green tahini sauce. But she also suggested a little horseradish cream, which I was thinking, just take a little sour cream and mix it with a little
horseradish.
Yeah, that's what you do with borscht often.
I'm all for horseradish.
So actually last night after I made it fresh, I didn't run out and have some sour cream, so I stirred in a little yogurt into it, and that was also really, really good. So that is it seems like beets and rhubarb are a really good pairing for savory things.
I wouldn't have thought, but that is a good thing. It's a very good thing.
I also found, can we do more recipes, right?
Yes, rhubarb? Yes,
okay.
Yes.
So when I was wandering around on the internet, there's a whole thing, a Martha Stewart thing, 36 rhubarb recipes that will inspire you to use this spring vegetable. Right?
Of course you would have 36.
Whatever. And a lot of them are, rhubarb apple cobbler, just rhubarb sauce and chutneys. She did a rhubarb syrup, which I think is a really good idea, which also will bring us to rhubarb shrubs, but we'll talk about that one later. Now, here's another thing that she did, which I think is a good idea, is to use it as a chutney for... she blended it with turmeric, cumin, garlic, onion, and ginger, and of course sugar, and then served it with chicken. I saw a lot of recipes like that. I think we did on the show one time.
Yeah.
I made a chutney recipe and served it with smoked salmon or something.
Oh, yeah.
A little sandwich or something. And pickled rhubarb, of course, pies. Now, here she's got her rhubarb and beet recipe. This is Martha Stewart. Is toss the rhubarb and baby beets in olive oil and roast until they're tender.
Oh, not make soup. That'd be kind of nice.
Yeah. That would be easy. And, you know, of course, a lot of dessert recipes. Now, the way to make a syrup out of it, which is, you know, you can add it to lemonade or you can use it instead of lemonade. Because as we said, the sourness of it can replace lemons in a lot of things, as well as tamarind, which is another tropical sour thing. So to make the syrup, you just boil the rhubarb and the sugar in a bunch of water till it's really stringy and cooked out as much as you want, and then strain it. You know, I just put it in my colander and let it drip through till it's about as dry as you can get it. And actually, sometimes I even use the solids for a compost after, compote afterwards. So, like, buttermilk panna cotta with rhubarb compote, you know. Easy peasy. So,
when you make the syrup, you're cooking it down. Is there sugar in that, or you add it later?
Okay. I cook it with the syrup. Well, because, you know, even if you want a simple syrup, which is just sugar and water, you're boiling the sugar so it, you know, gets kind of thick and syrupy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then once you have the syrup, you can, you know, as we said, make rhubarb aid, basically, or cocktails, or all kinds of other, like, other beverages. I can remember my dad telling me that in the harvest seasons, when, you know, everybody was out in the fields, the men were out in the fields and the women were in the kitchen making things to take care of the men in the fields. One of the thing, and this is before, you know, sodas and that kind of things were available, they would, you know, you have to hydrate. So they would make this mixture of rhubarb, and some people would put vinegar in because vinegar quenches thirst, but sour, make it pretty sour, and wild ginger. Like in the Midwest, we have a wild ginger. So they used to pick that, and so it would be the ginger, the rhubarb, and or the vinegar in the water, maybe a little sugar, but mostly the sour, you know, for hydration.
That'd be a good thing.
Yes. Which brings us to shrubs.
Shrubs.
Yes. Now, Lana's husband, Joe, made a rhubarb shrub the other night.
Oh, he did. And it was a fine thing.
It was good. We got the recipe from a book called Shrubs, An Old-Fashioned Drink for Modern Times by Michael Dietscht. D-I-E-T-S-C-H. Is that how you pronounce that?
Dietscht.
Okay. Anyway, under rhubarb shrubs, he tells two different ways to do this. Now, one is cooking the rhubarb, and the other one is a cold process where you place the rhubarb and sugar in a medium bowl, and you cover it and let it sit in the refrigerator macerating for up to 2 days. And what happens in that time is the sugar draws the liquid out of the... So in this book, he's suggesting using rhubarb as a way to... Because you can use these two techniques for other fruits, but he kind of says try both of them and see the difference. Because he says the rhubarb shrub cold process. So you do a pound of rhubarb diced, 2/3 cup of sugar, and then then you strain after 2 days. You strain the sugar rhubarb mixture. And then you combine the strained syrup with a little vinegar and whisk well to incorporate any undissolved sugar. So it says 1/2 cup of white wine vinegar. And I would say making shrubs, spring for a good vinegar. You know, a little, not the rot gut stuff, because it's a really predominant. And although I have not, like Joe said when he made it, and I thought the taste was really good. He did the cooked version I tasted the other day, which is also a pound of rhubarb, same amount of sugar, 3/4 cup, 1/2 cup of water. And then so you add water in the cooking one. Mm-hmm. And so you cook it with the sugar, then you strain it, then you add the vinegar. He said he used actually a homemade kombucha vinegar, which is slightly less acidic than... You know, like if you're going to use distilled white wine vinegar, that's pretty acidic.
Yeah, save that for cleaning your windows.
Exactly. Or if the vinegar that you're using has a real strong vinegar odor or bite, use less of it in the shrub. Yeah. I mean, my experience of, you know, this, you know, because people have been having fun making shrubs for a few years now. It's been a little bit fashionable. Some of the results that I've tasted are just too vinegar.
Yeah. You want zingy, but not, right. Not strip paint, okay?
Let's adding the vinegar in your thing, add a little taste, and taste as you go along. They are not meant to be scaldingly vinegary in your mouth at all.
Actually, you can add soda water or whatever to kind of cut them down, and they're a bit more of a soda.
It's a syrup that they're used to flavor other things, including cocktails, and it is good with bubbly water.
Yeah.
It's a concentrate, the shrub.
Wonderfully springy thing.
Yeah.
It's very good. It's a good use for rhubarb. Rhubarb can do a lot of things.
Yes, well, in this book, he does say that there's a difference in flavor between the cooked one and the not cooked one. He says the cold process is lighter in color and body, but richer in flavor. The hot process tastes more like rhubarb pie, but it lacks the freshness of flavor. So that's kind of a fun experiment with rhubarb around that you could be doing now and kind of taste them both together to educate your palate.
Very good. Very good. You're listening to KHOI Community Radio. KHOI has its own rhubarb patch out front. Yes, it does. And this is the Donalana Kitchen. You can find out recipes and more about this show and about this station at www.khoifm.org. Kitchen, welcome back. We are talking about rhubarb. We're talking about possibilities, and another sweet thing that we can make out of rhubarb is a rhubarb upside down cake, which is just putting the rhubarb in there. Would you cook it first?
No,
just lay it.
You don't need it's really, you can, I think, verbatim take a pineapple upside down cake, maybe more sugar, but I'm not sure. But
yeah, that would be good, and it's easy. Then you just dump the cake recipe or the cake batter, and which brings us
right. So the bottom is butter, sugar, and pieces of raw rhubarb.
Right.
Then you pour the cake mixture over it.
Lots of butter because you want to be able to take it out in the end. Good. Which kind of leads us to something. Donna and I were invited onto another KHOI program a couple of weeks ago. And Eric B. has a great program called the KHOI Jukebox. And he plays all kinds of good stuff from all the good years of the radio, like the 60s and 70s and 80s. Anyway, he has guests on, and he has kind of a quiz show. So and Donna and I were the recipients of, we were looking a little, they're sounding a little befrazzled on the radio because he'd play a tune, and we were supposed to guess what that had to do with the theme of the day, and he'd play another one, and see, this is what it had to do with the theme of the day.
Yeah, he basically made fools out of us.
Well, we had a wonderful time. Yeah. It was good. But the answer, what we were trying to come up with at the end, he had a whole bunch of
He was giving us musical clues.
Musical clues led us up to pineapple upside down cake, which I thought was pretty lovely.
Yeah, and he says it's a recipe he makes often, and it was something that his mother taught him how to do. And so if we're going to suggest that he try, we should bring him some rhubarb so he can try rhubarb upside down cake.
There you go. Well, lots of things on this station. Anyway.
There's another person to give rhubarb to.
Oh, good, good. Oh, before we go, we have another thing to talk about. Mushrooms. It's mushroom season.
Oh, I have to say, Lana invited me over for Sunday dinner and had the biggest pile of morel mushrooms I have ever had the pleasure to have met in my life.
You're welcome. When you have them, you just might as well cook them all up and eat them.
Tell me how you do this. How do you find I think the mushrooms speak to Lana
in
the woods.
Well, I think so, too. But I have, because I live on a farm, I visit the same spots every year. I look around dead elm trees. I kind of remember where to look. But I always respond. I kind of know what they're going to look like down there. The green is coming up off the forest floor. And I look for the color. They're just kind of peeking out. And there is a color kind of, not golden, but very tan and rich looking, poking out among the violets and the trout lilies that is not a violet or a trout lily. And if you find one, don't go stomping all over and hollering and saying, oh boy, here they are. Become very quiet and look in a circle, because actually mushrooms kind of do that. If you find one, you'll find another.
In a circle.
Generally, or at least around a tree.
A circle around where the tree might have grown.
Yeah,
right, so
yeah.
The roots would be underground.
Yeah.
Right.
Huh. That's
a big circle.
Big circle. And visit the places a couple times, but I look for the color first and then make sure to be very thorough. I do have good eyes, and so other things are falling apart, but my eyes still work, so I look
well fine. And you knew to go. We've had a good amount of rain that means the mushrooms are gonna
there are other mushrooms coming up. However, we found another news item tick-a-tick from the news department here. There is an invasive, I didn't realize these were invasive, but they are.
They are non-native.
Non-native golden oysters. And in the past couple of years, they've been popping up in my woods. Oh, boy.
Lots of them.
Golden oysters. And that's another pretty easy to identify. Very.
There's so many of them, even I could find them.
And these are golden. However, there is a warning, and it's kind of like the cat is out of the bag, because once mushrooms are out there, you're not really gonna get rid of them. Here's a note here.
Well, the warning is not culinary. You can eat them.
Oh, you can eat them.
In fact,
yes,
you should eat them as much as you can. They're taking over some of our native species.
Yeah, they are so hardy. They're pushing other ones out.
Competing some other rarer mushrooms.
And here's a note. You will never outrun a fungus. The fungus is going to win. And what it does, like all mushrooms, it is good at decomposing trees. That's its job. However, it is so good that it's kind of threatening the habitat for other mushrooms and bugs and birds and other things.
Right, it says that the golden oyster decomposes more quickly. So that the slower composters don't really have a chance.
Right. So, I don't know, you're kind of torn between, oh dear, I never should eat a golden oyster, or eat them all up, please, because maybe it'll give the other ones a chance.
Don't put them in your compost. Yeah, it did say that the suspicion is that how these non-native mushrooms jumped into our environment is that people were having home-growing mushroom kits and then disposing of the sub-material, which still, of course, has lots of spores in it, in compost that then spread into the wild, into the woods. So if you are growing these in a home-growing, you know, one of those mushroom box kits that you put in your kitchen or something, dispose of it very carefully.
Yeah, don't throw it out in the garden. Well, Well, like this article I'm reading says here, it's too late, folks. However, maybe in your area you don't have an infestation yet. And in the Midwest...
And don't make it worse.
Right. This is being studied by the University of Wisconsin. And so it's Mid-America, the Midwest, we're kind of... we are going to have a lot of golden oyster mushrooms. And... golden oysters are actually kind of lovely looking things.
They're pretty, they're delicious.
The morel, it comes up looking all wrinkledy and brain-like. This looks like a classic mushroom, and it grows on the side of a tree, usually.
So you can't miss them.
Yeah. So they'll, and then they come up in bunches. So, oh boy. Golden oysters. I like them. They're good.
Oh, we've been enjoying them from the last 2 years. But
yeah, they're great. The stems themselves can be a tad woody.
It's the tops you want.
But it's the tops. It's the tops. It's good. It's good. Great. We like mushrooms and we like rhubarb. Let's see. Because this is... people are... watch this sort of thing. Now we know that things that we do have consequences. So throwing away our mushroom boxes, not so good. So
well, what do you suppose you should do with them?
Oh, I don't know.
Put
them in a plastic bag and throw them away with your trash? You're not going to be dealing with huge amounts of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Putting things in plastic bags, that's always unfortunate.
Well, I know, but...
Yeah.
Well, it says... treat the grow block as a biohazard. Crumble finely and spread on your lawn or garden? No, I wouldn't do that. They'd get into the woods, but you could maybe put them on the driveway or something. Give them a chance to grow.
All right. Maybe the lesson is that if you're going to do homegrown mushrooms, don't do the golden oyster ones. Try to pick some of these kinds that are more native and less invasive.
Yeah, because you can get more and more.
Then you don't have to worry about getting rid of the grow box.
Mushrooms and fungi have been around in our environment for
a
long time.
Yes, there's a fungus among us.
And we will always have them, so we'll have to learn to enjoy them. I want to mention that coming up on this very radio station, there's a program called Big Picture Science, Friday at 4 o'clock, and they will be dealing with the topic of mushrooms. Huh? They're going to be talking about magic mushrooms.
Medicinal mushrooms, yes, and magic, the psilocybin ones.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're doing a lot of great research. I've been reading it as a treatment for PTSD and depression, and, there's some good things that come out of this if we have the opportunity in the scientific community to explore it as a medicine.
Huh, very good. Also, I want to mention coming up on this at this very radio station, we started out talking about a movie night that was held last Saturday, Saturday the 20th of this month. There's going to be an experimental film festival here at KHOI. We have this thing called an event space, otherwise referred to as the big room, and it's nice to have that. So that's Saturday... the 20th of this month, and it's an experimental film festival. So, very good. Lots of good things happening here.
Oh, we are busy this spring.
Yeah, it's actually very nice. Oh. Very nice. So, thank you for being with us today. We've talked about gestation crates and mushrooms and
rhubarb
and rhubarb. Lots of good things happening, and do tune into this radio station. Go to the KHOI website, find out what's going on. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find us here on the radio. We come to you live at noon, repeat at 7 p.m. or anytime at the website. Or we have a podcast, too.
Yes, we do. Donna Lana Kitchen. That's one word. Donna Lana, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, Kitchen.
That's it. My name is Lana Noctico.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
Excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.